Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly. They can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know, even though you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching never changed anything.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
This video is brought to you by Sailrite.
Hi, I'm Eric Grant with Sailrite. This is the Learning to Sew video series. We're going to go over some basics of the sewing machine, and a little bit later on, we're going to show you some practical techniques to get your sewing project off beautifully. To get started sewing, we need to understand a little bit of the basics of a sewing machine. So we're going to go over some of the components of the machine. And starting on this side, we have the balance wheel. This is what drives a sewing machine, and typically there's a belt mounted to the balance wheel. And then moving over, we have the length lever down here. The length lever controls the stitch length. All the way at the top on this sewing machine is the longest stitch length. And then going down, this would be a shorter stitch length. And then all the way at the bottom, this would be reverse. On some sewing machines, the length lever is a knob, and sometimes the reverse is actually a button. On this machine, it is actually a lever. Up here, we have the width lever. This lever controls the straight stitch, and then anything over all the way to the left would be a zigzag stitch, because this is a zigzag straight stitch machine. This lever controls the needle position. All the way over, the needle's to the left, and center, and right. So the needle can be moved left, right, or center to get closer to hard objects like zippers or bolt rope. So you may not necessarily need to replace a presser foot on this sewing machine because you have a needle positioning lever at the top here. One of the most important knobs on the sewing machine is the tension knob. This knob controls the tension of the thread. So if you have a loose stitch on the bottom side, you need more upper tension. So remember, upper tension assembly or upper tension knob. That's an important feature of a sewing machine. And then on this machine, we have the foot lifter lever, which is up on the top of this machine. Oftentimes on other sewing machines, you'll find them in the back and you lift the lever and the presser foot lifts up. Your sewing machine will also have a foot pedal. This is a variable speed foot control. The further down you go, the faster the machine, the less pressure, the slower the machine operates. All sewing machines operate with a bobbin, that is if it's a lock stitch machine. Some home sewing machines will have a slide plate at the top where you drop the bobbin in above. On the Alter Feed sewing machine, the bobbin is underneath and you need to slide this plate open to gain access to the bobbin underneath. I'm going to tilt the machine back so we can see the bobbin below. A locking stitch machine requires a bobbin to create a stitch, so you have to fill bobbins when they run out, and we will be showing you that in the series. We're going to set the sewing machine up in preparation for you to get started sewing. One of the first things you need to do on a sewing machine is basically plug it in. Obviously, we plugged it into the wall, but many sewing machines have a plug that has to be plugged into the sewing machine from the side. So now we have power. And now threading of the machine is required. There are two types of thread for the most part. You have an industrial thread and you have a home sewing thread. A home sewing thread can be pulled from the side like this, but if you pull on an industrial Kona thread from the side, notice it doesn't spin. So this can cause all kinds of tensioning problems. This type of home sewing thread bobbin goes up here, and an industrial cone goes on a thread stand, and you must pull it off the top of the cone. Okay, so now we're pulling off the top of the cone. Let's remove the home bobbin and get ready for threading. Since we don't have any thread underneath in the bobbin, that is our first task. So I'm going to show you how to wind a bobbin. We need to come off of our cone of thread. We're using an industrial cone, so we're coming off the top. On the Alter Feed sewing machine, we have what looks like a pigtail. We'll feed the thread through that pigtail and then come around the bobbin tension assembly. This gives the thread some tension prior to the bobbin itself. And then we come over to the spindle for the bobbin. Now we need to place a bobbin on this spindle. Okay, we first need to get the bobbin out of the sewing machine. You may have some spare bobbins and you could just fill those up, but we're going to pull the bobbin from underneath the sewing machine because it's empty right now. We're going to lift the machine up, we're going to grab the lever of the bobbin case, pull it towards the end of the machine, and pull out the case and the bobbin. Now to remove the bobbin from its case, let go of the lever, and then simply turn it upside down, and the bobbin comes out. Now we'll take the bobbin and put it on the spindle at the top and push it down. Now we'll take our thread that we already have coming through the pre-tensioner and feed it through one of the holes in the bobbin. If your bobbin does not have holes, you can wrap it around the bobbin several times and that will hold the thread in place as well. To disengage our drive so the needle does not go up and down, we're going to pull the posi pin from the balance wheel. We can stick it in the keeper of this sewing machine. Some sewing machines, as we talked about, has a friction clutch knob. So you would disengage the friction clutch knob, so that would disengage the needle, so the balance wheel would still spin so you can wind bobbins. Now, kick the spindle over towards the balance wheel. That will engage the bobbin. Next step, just press on the foot control. The foot control is up here on the table so you can see it, and you'll notice the bobbin will spin. Once you've wound enough thread on the bobbin, you can take your scissors or seam ripper and you can cut the thread off the top and dispose of that. And then continue to wind. Once the bobbin's full, this will either stop spinning or will automatically kick over. On this machine, it stops spinning. That bobbin is now full. Now that the bobbin's full, we'll just cut the thread. Now we'll take our bobbin case and insert our bobbin inside the case. On our sewing machine, the bobbin needs to spin clockwise when you pull on the thread. Some sewing machines are different, so refer to your manual for more information about that. We'll put the bobbin into the case. There's a little slit in the side of the bobbin case. We'll pull the thread through the slit and underneath the spring to the opening. Now your bobbin's ready for use. To insert a bobbin in the sewing machine, you need to make sure that the needle is not down in the bobbin area. So we're going to roll the balance wheel around so the needle's up. Now you can open up the side plate and put your bobbin in, or tilt the machine back. Hold on to the lever. That keeps the bobbin from falling out of the case. And then push it over the spindle. And you may hear a click, or you may not hear a click, depending on when you let go of the lever. Wiggle the bobbin case to make sure it doesn't fall out. Leave at least 4 inches of thread dangling underneath the machine. Now we're ready to thread the sewing machine. We're going to pull the thread out of the bobbin tensioner. We're going to go through this pigtail on this machine. We're going to go through this guide here. There are 3 holes in it. And we're going to go through this first hole on the right and then the last hole on the left to make a candy cane stripe. Now I'm going to place my finger on top of the thread here so that I can have a little bit of tension when I pull on the thread here. I'm going to go around the upper tension assembly, making sure that I'm going through the discs.
When threading a machine, you must make sure that the presser foot is up. Here I'm going to use a screwdriver and I'm going to wiggle the tension discs. You'll see they are separated. If I lower the presser foot and try to wiggle the tension discs, you'll notice they're nice and solid. It's very difficult to pass the thread through tension discs when the presser foot is down. So lift the presser foot prior to threading.
Then I'm going to pull the thread up and catch the take-up spring, and I'm going to make sure that the thread goes through this little finger. Now I can let go of the thread up above. Now I'm going to roll the balance wheel so that the take-up arm is in the upper position so I can gain better access to it. Now I'll go through the take-up arm from right to left. Above the needle, there's a needle bar thread guide, which is basically a hole to guide the thread. So we're going to insert the thread from the front side out the back of that guide. And now we'll feed it through the needle from left to right. You need the thread to come down in a straight manner. Once the thread's through the eye of the needle, we're going to pull up the bobbin thread underneath. And to do that, just simply hold on the tail of the thread off to the right. We'll hold fairly loose, and we'll rotate the balance wheel towards you. Roll the balance wheel, hold the thread loosely. Once the take-up arm is almost at the top here, the take-up arm we showed you earlier, we'll pull on the thread, and that will pull up the bobbin thread underneath. Now you can take any object and pass it underneath the presser foot, and that will lift the bobbin thread all the way through. Now, we'll just pass this thread through the middle of the presser foot. Our sewing machine is threaded, and in the next video, we're going to show you how to sew.
This video is brought to you by SailRite.
Welcome to part 2 of the video series Learning to Sew. We're going to get started here, and we're going to show you how to sew on some scrap fabric. We're going to show you how to start your stitch, and we're also going to show you how to make turns, whether it be in the fabric as we're sewing or from a stop position with the needle buried in the fabric. So let's get started and show you how to sew. We've pulled some scrap fabric from the Sayerite loft. This is a fairly light fabric, and we're going to fold it over to 2 layers. You always need to consider the weight of the fabric when you begin your sewing. Since this is a light fabric, we need to go with a fairly medium thread, like a V69, and a size 16 needle. So that's what we have in the sewing machine now. 2 layers is a good place to start because we can determine if the stitch tension is correct with 2 layers better than we can with anything else. So when you put your fabric underneath the foot, we'll need to lower the presser foot via the presser foot lever at the top. So we'll lower the presser foot, and you'll notice that there are 2 threads that are dangling out from behind the fabric at this point. One thread is underneath the fabric, and that's the bobbin thread, and the other thread is on top, that's coming from the needle. It's always important to hold the threads prior to your first stitch, that way you don't get a rat's nest underneath. So hold your threads and start sewing. Once you have 1 or 2 stitches done, you can let go of the thread and continue to sew. Now I've sewn for a few inches here, and what we want to do is we want to lift the presser foot and check our thread tension. So we'll pull the fabric out And notice as I roll the balance wheel, that lets me to pull the fabric out without having the threads get caught. So sometimes I roll the balance wheel back and forth to pull the fabric out easier. Let's check the top stitch here. You'll notice that there are no knots on the top side, or actually I see a little knot there. So there is a knot a little bit on the top side. The bottom side looks great. So I think, and you can see a little knot here, so this is about perfect tension. Now if the tension were poor, we may have loose stitches on the bottom side. That would mean that there's not enough upper tension with the upper tension assembly. If the knots were being pulled on the top side through the fabric, it would mean we have too much upper tension and we'd have to turn this knob counterclockwise to loosen the tension. Let's show you what it's like when you get a bad stitch on the bottom side. Let's roll this knob several rotations. On this machine, this has about 6 full rotations. Some home sewing machines only have about 1 rotation. The Sarite UltraFeed has a lot of versatility for the upper tension assembly. Let's lower the foot again. It's always important to lower the foot prior to sewing, and we notice our needle is out of the fabric. So lower the foot. Now, we don't necessarily have to hold on to the trailing threads because the threads weren't cut. So I'm not going to have to worry about that. We probably won't get a rat's nest because of that. So now we'll start sewing, and we'll notice on the back side, the stitch will not be nearly as nice. With the needle lowered, we have to make sure that the needle's out, obviously, to pull the fabric out. So I'll roll the balance wheel towards me to make sure the needle is out of the fabric. When the needle's out of the fabric, we'll lift our presser foot. Now, to pull the fabric out, again, we'll wiggle the balance wheel, and that allows us to pull the fabric out nicely. Top side, it doesn't look that great. Look at that. Bottom side, not nearly enough tension. That is a major lack of tension. So what we'll do is we'll put the fabric in again, we'll lower the presser foot, we're going to increase the upper tension, 1, 2, 3, 4, that's 2 full revolutions, 4 half revolutions, and now let's sew again. Let's take a look at it. The needle's down, we need to roll the balance wheel so the needle's up, lift the presser foot and check again. Beautiful. Now let's do some rotating of the fabric. Lower the presser foot. We don't have to hold the trailing threads because we didn't cut them. And let's roll. As we sew, we can actually make turns. It's not a good idea to have the needle slightly buried in the fabric and then make a sharp turn because the needle may bend. And then when you press on the foot pedal, you may break a needle or hit something metal down below. So in a stop position, let's say we've sewn for a while, and we want to make a 90-degree turn. We'll bury the needle by hand with the balance wheel. We can lift our foot. We can pivot on the deep part of the needle, in other words, the part that's reinforced because it's thicker at the top. We can lower our presser foot and then continue to sew. In the position where the needle is up, if we wanted to make a 90-degree turn without burying the needle, we lost our position. Notice it's not going to be a really nice 90 degree because of the fact that we didn't keep the needle buried in the position, so this is too long of a stitch there, but this is a perfect 90 degree. All right, we have tension set appropriately. We are actually ready to sew. Now, I'm not going to get a new piece of fabric because we basically set tension for this. So I'm going to cut my threads, and let's act like we're now ready to start our project. It's a good idea to cut threads, leaving at least about 4 inches of trailing threads. All right, we're going to put the fabric underneath the foot. Now I've cut my threads, so I have to hold on to the trailing threads. Lower my presser foot. And the official thing you should do when you start sewing is actually do a reverse stitch to lock your stitch in place. It's not a good idea to just sew without locking the stitch in place because that end of the stitching may come loose. So we're going to sew a couple stitches, let go of my trailing threads, and we're going to sew a couple stitches more, and we're going to put the machine in reverse via the stitch length lever, and we're going to sew in reverse. Then we're going to put the machine back and forward, maximum stitch length, 6 millimeters for the UltraFeed, and sew forward. Now, let's say this is where we need to stop sewing. What I should do there is I should do some bar tacking as well. So I'm going to put the machine in reverse to lock the stitch in place. And now our stitch is locked in both the forward position where we started and the in position, so it will not easily come undone. This machine is a zigzag straight stitch machine. Let's put it in zigzag and show you how that's done as well. Remember, the stitch width lever is up here. So we're going to put the machine in zigzag by flipping this lever, or moving this lever, all the way to the left. If you're going to switch from a straight stitch to a zigzag, make sure the needle's out of the fabric. It already was because we didn't have the fabric underneath the foot. Now we'll lower the presser foot. We'll hold on to our trailing threads. We'll sew. We'll do some reversing to lock our stitch in place. And then at the end, we do some reversing again to lock our stitch in place. And that's a zigzag stitch. Now that's the maximum zigzag for this sewing machine. Here, you notice we caught the trailing thread. We have a lot of threads on the backside. You can just pull those out. A zigzag stitch is typically used in sail making, and some dressmakers use it as a decorative stitch. Now let's move on and sew something that a lot of our customers think is difficult to sew, which is a vinyl mesh material. It is not difficult. Let's move on and show you that next. A vinyl mesh material is extremely easy to sew. In fact, it sews like butter, is what I always say. We put it under the presser foot, we'll lower the presser foot, trap our threads with our finger, and sew. Make sure you do some reversing if this is an official stitch. Sew all the way through. Reverse at the end. Now let's switch to from zigzag to straight stitch. Let's say the needle's buried in the fabric. I don't want to switch now because watch what happens. See the needle bend? Not good. Make sure the needle's out of the fabric when you switch. Now I can switch to straight stitch. We can turn corners as we sew, and then when we're done, do some reversing. And look how beautiful the stitch is. From zigzag to straight stitch. Bottom side looks great too. And that's how easy it is to sew a stitch. The next video series is seaming. That's coming up next.
All right, let me ask you a question. How many of you are familiar with the retail website Etsy? Well, my next guest is a mother of three who turned these handmade goods into a multi-million dollar brand using Etsy. She's today's mystery millionaire. She's somewhere in the audience. Anybody? Well, mystery millionaire, come on down. Yeah. Yeah. How are you?
Good, how are you?
Yeah, she looked like she'd have made a million. You just look happier when you got a million. I don't know what that is. Please welcome Alicia. Hi, Alicia.
Hi.
Tell us about your business.
So my business is Three Bird Nests, and these are a collection of some of our products that we have. We range from headbands to scarves to legwear. This year alone, we're projected to do over 2 million, so that's quite exciting.
Now, there's something unique about your employees. What is that?
I love to employ other moms. Me, myself, I have three kids. I still run carpool. I still have dirty laundry. I still have, you know, stuff that keeps me from running into work at a normal business hour. So a lot of the other moms that work for me, if they need a day off, you know, to pick up their child because mm-hmm. they're sick, I love to be able to support that because I'm a mom, too, and I right. get it.
Right. So how'd you get started?
So I got started originally with, I had a brick and mortar store in our downtown, and it was when the economy wasn't doing so good. We weren't doing so well financially, so I had made a couple of the knitted headbands, which you see here, and I said, you know what, I want to put them online, but it's really daunting to start your own website. It's hard to, you know, get traffic to you. So I started the business out on Etsy with, as Steve was mentioning, it's just a global marketplace. So you can sell handmade goods, vintage goods, anything that's not essentially mass produced. And so I initially put a couple headbands up, and it takes typically a few weeks to start getting orders. And we got three within a couple days, and then 30, and then we had 300, and then I started crying because I wasn't sure how we were going to fill all the orders. But now we've actually left Etsy. We have our own website now where we can sell everything from full looks to shoes to, you know, all of our handmade goods and everything now.
Okay, what are the keys for anybody out there? What's the keys to selling online?
You know, really, I have three that I go off of every day. And, you know, the first one is be better than the next click. And what do I mean by that? It means if you're searching for a product, are you going to click on your photo? Is yours the one that is going to be the most interesting? And really, if it's not, be better than that. Mm-hmm. And the second one is really invest in the details. Your title on your product, does it really truly describe what your product is? Do the photos tell a story? Are you really creating a brand? Are you consistent with everything you do? And, you know, really the third one is learn how to set up your shop. Learn the tools that are in place from whichever marketplace you choose. And, you know, take advantage of watching the videos like I did. I watched all the videos. I reached out to other sellers. I did my research on, you know, who did good on the marketplace, who didn't, and why, and really try to just be better than that.
Mm-hmm. The reason we do these Mystery Millionaires is because we have a lot of moms watch your show, a lot of women. Listen to me. There's something in you that may be laying dormant that could be the next big idea. But if you don't produce the action to get it started, it could just lay there. You never know. It started with three headbands, about to do $2 million. I don't care if it's making cookies, cutting up ribbons, doing eyebrows, doing hair, something. You got something, man. Get started. Don't sit there and just not follow your dream. Take a shot at it. You never know. So I want to thank Alicia for coming out. Hope you all got something from it. Thanks a lot. Hey, what's your website?
Threebirdnest.com.
Threebirdnest.com. We'll be right back, everybody. Threebirdnest.com.
Greetings once again. This is Gentleman Jim the Tailor, and Victoria's not in her seat.
Here I am.
Guess what? She's doing some personal filming this morning, but she's here with me. Say hello, Victoria.
Hey, I'm behind the camera, guys. How are you doing?
There was a question that came up about how I organize or how to organize a sewing room. Now, it depends on the space that you have to work with. Now, me, I have a big space, so you guys cannot look at it the way I have mine set up, because this is not the way I would set up my personal one. But let me kind of walk you through a few things of how I would set it up. Now, normally, the way I set a workspace up, you try and make it as convenient as you can. I have my primary sewing machine, and depending on how much space you guys have, I would set my primary sewing machine up there. Now here, I have my serger. Normally, I would turn the serger behind. Or if you have a personal workshop and you have it on tables, I would set the primary sewing machine up. I would set the serger right next to it. And if you can L-shape it somehow, like a lot of people do, you can use one chair. And what I would normally do is I would be sewing here, and all I would have to do is pivot my chair, and I'd be right at the other one. Secondly, those are usually the two primary sewing machines that you have. You have a regular sewing machine and you have a serger. The third thing I would do is I would station, my iron station in that same similarity area. Why? People waste a lot of steps going back and forth to an iron that's across the room. Now, depending on how big your space is, what you see with a primary sewing machine, you would have a table like this, and you'd also have another table with your serger on. If you had, and get a good chair too. So you get a good chair. Now I use a swivel chair because I do a lot of swiveling. But if you have them there, see, all you would have to do is swivel around to where your serger would be. And you shouldn't have to get up but so far to get to wherever your iron station is. That's the key to it is eliminate steps. And sometimes people have their sewing here and the iron across the room. Depending on, like I say, how big your space is. Some people use part of a bedroom. Some people physically have a space. Some people sew in a kitchen where they use the table, their dining room table as it. It kind of really all depends on it. Secondly, what I do is I keep extra tools, so I have to go look for one. I have scissors. I have my cutting knives. I have my threads where I can get right to them. I shouldn't have to go across the room and get them. I should have everything within arm's length. And some of you guys, this is 1,500 square feet that I operate out of, so it's a big space. The guys who have smaller space should always have everything you need within arm's length, because at that rate, you don't have to get up and go across the room. You keep extra tools. If you only have one pair of scissors, and most people do or don't, regardless of the fact, you need some snips as well as scissors. So you can have your scissors here, have you some snips, have you a few cutting knives, have all of that so where you don't have to, well, let me look in a box for them. They should be right on top of you. This is how you know, I always talk about time management. Well, steps of time management. They're always on top of you. They're always where you need to be, and you should always be prepared. I have my little small ruler handy. I keep a little ripper here. I have my machine dust brush, so we get the little dust particles out of the machine. I have everything. Now, I built myself a little pouch here, so it's right there. Now, if you have a stationary area, this is nothing more but a little pouch I made out of a little piece of denim. I got pockets in it. I keep my thread handy. Keep everything right where I need. I got some crackers over there, too, in case I get hungry. And I keep water at my disposal. I want to make sure that I don't have to get up any extra steps that I need. That's kind of the way I do it. Now, like I say, this is a real big space, so my machines are in place like I told you guys to. But when I operated out of a small area, that's where, and most of you guys are operating out of a small area. That's why I gave you guys a scenario of the small area. Now, if you got a big old space like this, but see, I teach in this space. So I have sewing machines everywhere. So that when my students come in, it's there. The iron station just happens to be over there only because. But if I was in a tighter area, I would tighten up everything, but I would keep everything in arm's length. See, just like I keep my lovely Victoria in arm's length.
Oh, he's so sweet.
But that's the way I do it. That question came about. Let me see who sent that question in again.
Oh, we're having a logging issue. Sorry.
That's all right.
My phone.
We want to give you your notice, honey.
We'll give you credit.
Uh-huh.
Oh, here we go.
Okay.
There we go. Here's my cell phone.
All right. Lorraine Williams sent that question in, and we want to thank her for sending it in, because, like I say, a lot of times you guys have, you guys get your stuff scattered everywhere, and when you go to look for something, you can't find it. So if you keep it consolidated, then you can find it. Then the other thing that I do, I tell you, I keep my threads in the area. I also keep a little canister with some of my primary threads in it. Sometimes you have to look for an odd thread, yes. But the colors, see, that I use all the time are right here with me. And this way I don't have to look for them. Because like I say, looking for them takes time. Oh, where did I put that? You're trying to figure out, oh, it's in a box. Oh, it's over here. So if you keep your primary stuff out, I can understand you're going to look for an odd cover. But if you keep your primary threads and supplies and things that you need, pins and needles and whatnot, where you can put your hand on them. Because if you're sewing, that's the worst feeling, is to get up and can't remember where something is. So by doing that, I eliminate the time and the effort of having to look. And like I say, I buy a couple extra these, a couple extra that's, because I don't want to have to look for it. Now, in this studio here, because it's so big, oh, trust me, I got little cutting knives everywhere. I have scissors everywhere. I got tape measures everywhere. I just have the one. I have them hanging all over. Because if I want something, I want to be able to have it when I need it. I've got my straight rulers. I've got everything.
Where are your rulers at, Mr. Jim?
Pardon me?
Your rulers? I'm going to show you your nifty way of hanging your rulers.
Oh, there's different sizes of rulers, see?
Now right off your cutting table.
This is my cutting table here. Now, like I said, you guys might not have one this big. This is
huge.
10, this is 18 feet long. So I can cut a lot of stuff. But then I keep, like I said, I keep my rulers, the different kinds that I keep, everything where I can put my hand on them. I don't put them in a box and put it under something where I got to, first of all, I got to remember where I put it. And even though you know, sometimes you forget, well, which one, then I don't have to pull them out of a box. And I make everything convenient where I can just hang them here. Like I say, I have tape measures around here. I've got chalk where I need it. You name it, I have it. Now, understand, it's not that, it's because of the school. I've always done this. We were always taught you shouldn't have to really look hard for something. It should be at arm's length, and that's what I keep. But because this place is so big, it's spread out. But most of, like I say, you guys either operate out of a small bedroom, so you can't have this machine here and that one there. But when you operate in a small bedroom, you just tighten everything up, but you make it so that you can turn around and get to it just like that, you know. This is just one of the things that I learned a long time ago. I keep up with really everything that I've done all my life. I don't change a pattern on certain things. I change this pattern because of size. I had a smaller area in my other location that I operated, it was the same size, it was cut up differently. It wasn't open like this. So, but in my primary sewing room, I had everything just like I said. Well, all I had to do was pivot my chair, and everything was right there. How you like that? Pivot my chair, and everything was right there.
So, Mr. Jim, where do you keep your fabric at and your patterns?
My fabric and my patterns. Now, my extra fabric, because I have so much, I keep down under my cutting table. Once again, you don't have a cutting table like this. Most people have some type of shelving. Now, I got shelving, I really have nothing on it. Few things. But people that have shelving, they put their fabric on the shelving. Some people have bins. They put it in a bin. The patterns that I use are all in canisters. And I keep them stocked. And I have them not necessarily alphabetized. I have them style by style. I got all the pants in one section, all the tops in another section, all the jackets in another section. I keep them all in different sections. My vintage patterns, I keep in a tub. So the worst thing you want to do is have, you're looking for a vintage pattern, or you're looking for a pants pattern, but you got to thumb through everything. So if you keep them organized, keep all the pants in one area, all the jackets, all the blouses, all the shirts, all the skirts, they're all in an area where I can just take a whole handful of them and just go through them and see which ones they have. Then I have most used patterns. I keep them in a little I guess you would call that like a gift bag, but it's more or less a little shopping bag. But most used patterns, now they might be mixed in different things, pants, skirts, but these are the ones that are most used. As I tell you guys all the time, I don't create no patterns. I take a part of this pattern and add it with a part of that. I can take any standard pattern and make just about anything out of it, by just adding or subtracting. I could take a pants pattern that's straight. I can make a palazzo pants out of it. It's just increasing the size of the leg. I could take a pants that has a wide leg, I can make it narrower. I could take a pair of pants if they wanted a bell bottom, but they were straight. That's all in the cut and how I'm going to cut it to get it to that size. I could take a pants that has a waistband and don't add the waistband, but I have to still finish the top of the pants. So there are all kind of ways, and I do things differently only because of the way I was taught. I teach my in-house students that. I try to teach them all the little ins and outs. And then I have my professional patterns. These are patterns that are made out of oak, what's called oak tag. These are hard stock pattern paper. And I saw somebody who had commented on using this type of stock. It's called like, it's just like card stock, but it's heavier. Doesn't get flimsy like your regular tissue paper patterns do. I saw where somebody had on Facebook had talked about they got a pattern from, I don't know who it was, and I forgot what they paid for it, but it came in this type of stock. Now, let's say you have a favorite pattern that you want to use, and it comes from the tissue paper kind. Well, you can buy this paper at a lot of the art supply stores, or you can go online and find it and get it. If you want to take your flimsy tissue paper pattern and you want to make it like this, it's an easy way to do it. Once you have the sizing, because remember, patterns that you buy don't come to necessarily fit that the garment is. Well, if it's for you, and you've made all the changes on it, make it on the pattern. You could take the tissue paper pattern rather than try and outline it on this type of stock, because this stock comes in rolls. And I happen to have the professional roll. This must be 75 inches wide, and you could. This came in a 100-yard roll, but I've made a lot of patterns. Now, it doesn't come like this unless you buy it through a professional house. Theirs comes probably about 45 inches wide, whereas this comes 75 inches wide. But what you do is you take your tissue paper pattern, you take your tissue paper pattern that you'll have like this, and if you want to transfer it onto the hard stock, do not try and outline it because your lines are going to be wavy. Make it real simple. Get your glue stick. Glue stick the pad. Actually, put the paper down first. The hard stock paper, this paper here. Put this down first. And put your, take your glue stick and you run your glue stick around it and you pat this on it. And once you pat it on it, then you can cut it out. And you'll have it looking like this, except you'll have the paper pattern on there. What you're trying to do, you know, every time you make a pattern, see how this one is? You fold it back and you put it in the bag. You need to iron it flat again before you use it. This way it'll stay flat. See how I keep them hanging? These are just the basic sizes. From these sizes, I make just about any pants or jacket. Now, if I was doing a lot of blouses or whatnot, especially if it was for yourself, I'd do it the same way once I've made my adjustments. I would put it on some hard stock because I know I'm going to continuously make these. This way I don't have to unfold it, press it flat. It'll already be like this. So that's what I do with my patterns. I buy these type of threads. I think I told you about them. These are professional threads. These are for doing all of your hand sewing. They come at a length that when you take one out, they come at a length that does not tangle because they're waxed. So when you do hand work, a lot of times you'll be sewing and you get a little knot in it, these won't knot up. Plus, What a lot of people make a bad mistake is when they hand sew with hand thread, they cut the piece too long. And now they got knots in it, tanglement in it, loops over, you got all kind of things. This won't do that. And it's at a length which will give you a good distance of sewing. You don't need it too long. And it's going to come off, and you reuse what you don't use, you reuse it. When you run out where you're hemming or finishing it, just grab another piece. Because it will stay not tangled up. Whereas sometimes when you have your regular mercerized cotton or your poly cotton threads, you lay them down, they get tangled up. Now you got to try and figure it out. Gets a little knot in it. Oh, you got to take the knot out of it. This will not knot. This will not knot. So those are the things that I do. The way, like I say, I have my sewing room set up. I showed you guys once before. This is a blind stitch machine. Now, it's a professional one, but you can also buy a table model that sits on a table. This is in stand and motor. It's all built in, but this is a professional kind. This, mind you, hems your garments, so you don't have to do it by hand. But unless you were really in business and did a lot, if you had an alteration business, you need one of these, because this is where your speed comes in. If you don't, you can buy a table model. Victoria, you have a table model.
I do.
You know, and it looks just like this, except you have to sit it on a table where this is built into the table. The difference between Victoria's model, she has a smaller motor in it. It's about as big as my fist, whereas this one has an industrial motor in it.
Right under there.
See, that has an industrial motor. So with that, this will last forever. But hers will last forever, too, because you're not constantly using it. If you don't overuse it, the motor won't burn out. You can spend 100 years sewing on this and never burn the motor out. But those are the things that are in. I showed you guys once before a professional iron. Okay, this iron gets a lot of use. This is called gravity feed. The water feeds down so you constantly can get steam anytime you press that little button there. Whereas most irons, you have to tip them over before the steam comes out. So, but these are some professional things that we buy in the industry, and I hear and I see a lot of Facebookers that are showing that they have this iron now. This iron makes all the difference in the world. All the difference in the world. And I hear them say, oh, I can press so good. You can press anything with this iron here. Right. So you have that. And then, like I say, I mainly use industrial machines. And I teach on both the portable ones like you guys have. Because that's what they were called once upon a time. Portable. Because they were portable, but you could pick them up and move them around. And I use these periodically, but I teach on these. But any one of my students that wants to learn on an industrial, I have plenty of industrial machines for them to learn on as well. That's the story, guys. We're so thankful, Ms. Williams, for the question. And we continue to tell you guys, send in a question. We will answer it to our best ability. So I'm saying, sayonara. Au revoir. See you guys later. And Miss Victoria wants to say
the same. Bye, guys.
Bye now.
See you next time.
Hi, guys. Gentlemen, Jim. Who is that coming?
Jim, here, let me.
It's the dressmaker. Who are you?
Just abruptly interrupting. Are we really starting here?
Yeah.
Woo, this is Candid. It's our bloopers this morning. Hi, everybody. Victoria Baylor, dressmaker.
Thank you for being here with me.
Well, thank you for having me.
I thought I was going to be here by myself.
Oh, my God.
I didn't want to cry.
Mr. Jim has been busy working in his workshop, just turning
it's a
out
mess,
jackets.
Too.
Have you you guys been following along with him on, of course, you're on Instagram?
Instagram, Facebook.
Facebook. He's posting in all the major sewing groups.
Mm-hmm.
You should be seeing, like, a new jacket and suit every day.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Mr. Joe's doing. So, anyway, welcome to our show. We know it's been a little bit little time lapse. Things have been a little bit crazy in our world.
Yeah, it has.
But, you know, we love to reconnect with you guys. So we're going to start this show actually by just answering a question that I received recently, Mr. Gemini.
Yeah.
And we'll kind of talk about it because we like to think about the full scope of answering questions with you. So here is our question. And our question comes from the fabulous Golden Seal. Mrs. Seal, Miss Golden, I hope you don't mind that I said your name. She's a wonderful viewer of ours. And her question is, she says, first of all, she wants to say she's an avid watcher. Thank you, Golden. We appreciate you watching us and the follower. But her question is, I am starting a sewing business from home myself, and my husband found a client for me. The only thing is the client lives in Ohio, and she lives in New York.
New York City.
That's right. So they're kind of, they're good. Ohio, how far is it? I'm geographically challenged. That's a good bit of distance, right?
Yeah.
Okay, that's right. That's like Midwest.
Central.
Ohio. Yeah. And then, of course, the East Coast is New York. So her question is it possible to have a long-distance business with clients away from your hometown? And if so, how do you make it work? And then her idea, she says, because I would think fitting would be an issue, but my husband feels like I can do it, but I'm not sure. Shout out to our husbands for the vote of confidence.
Shout
That's
out.
Very sweet. You must have some really great abilities.
Yeah.
You got your hubby behind you. And then she just asks, what can you share with me about this? She's asking our opinion. How do you deal with, can you really sew for clients that are in your hometown?
Well,
what are your thoughts
I do
sir?
It quite a bit. And a lot of you guys, I know you guys do it because nobody's at your doorstep. Okay. The key issue is to get precise, exact measurements. It's all about measurements. Now, how do you do that? Well, for one, you need good body measurements. That's number one. Secondly, what I always tell people, and it depends on what you're making again, is what are you making? Okay. Because if it's, for argument's sake, a pair of pants, a pair of slacks for whoever, you need the waist and the seat are the most important measurements on that. Then you need a length. Then you need how wide is the leg going to be. Best way to do that is to have them measure something that they like the fit, not just measure any old thing.
And even with that being said, I oftentimes have my clients just bring a pair of pants.
Yeah, they can bring
like something they have that were, and it's a good kind of reference. I totally agree with you.
I have a client who's is another city, and what he does is I've been doing some, this has just been an alteration, but he'll send me a pair of pants the way he likes to fit because he lost a lot of weight, and I just duplicate him.
Very helpful.
See?
So I think, so what, and Mr. Jim and I like to, we always like to play good cop, bad cop with situations. So this is a very good question for one, and it's a very, to some degree, it can be a complex answer just depending upon what you sew, like what Mr. Jim said. So if you're working and doing things that are unfitted, like we have a friend we know that makes gorgeous, loosely fitted jackets. Anybody can buy those because it's not really relegated on a specific number. You have 5, 6, 7, 8 inches of ease. Perfect. A lot of people fit in that.
Yeah.
But the closer something fits to someone, that's when it sometimes can get a little tricky, especially when you're working with non-knits.
Yeah.
So it really comes down, just like Mr. Jim says, at least kind of the way I think about it, measurements, let's see, client body measurements, type of garment, and I had a couple other notes, fabric type, and then it really boils down to the comfort of the individual that's sewing it. So, like, for me specifically, I have a rule. I don't sew a ton of fitted stuff for people that I can't fit personally. I'm a hands-on, technical, like to touch my client's feet kind of person. But I do make dresses and stuff like that I can ship that are more, you know, loose and fit a variety of body measurements. So, I do, yeah.
And so, notes that you could do also is have them take a picture of themselves.
Yeah.
Picture always is a very good thing because you see the sculpture of their body.
Yep.
Whereas you're guessing at it because they could be short-waisted.
Yep.
Long-waisted.
Mm-hmm.
They could have a lot here and less there.
Absolutely.
Right? So with a picture, you can kind of see these things. And it, like I say, it depends on your comfort level. And because you're starting a business at home, and your husband was kind enough to get you this long-distance client, tell them to work on the locals where you can find them.
That's true, too. And he's absolutely right. So there's the answer, like, in general, there's no surefire way. You want to just use your best, wisest judgment. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when you're starting out, you know, you do want to be careful not to be too ambitious and take on stuff that you don't feel comfortable. And then one way to just kind of dip your toe in the water is grab a friend, make something for
there
them that is local. Fit, so we've discussed in previous things, Mr. Jim and I, in complete agreement. Sewing is comprised of, or making garments from, there's the sewing aspect, there's the fitting aspect. You have to become an aficionado, like both of them. You have to be really good and fit. Sometimes ends up being the trickiest part, even out the sewing.
That's right.
Because sewing's more mechanical. Fit takes a little bit of knowledge, experience. You're totally right. I look at people and I see posture.
Sure.
Like, how do they slant sideways? Mm-hmm. Some people have high rears. Some people are low in the front. Mm-hmm. Like, they're not all straight. And when you were talking about arms, are they meatier up here in the bicep?
That's right.
They might need a little bit more space. So maybe there's a way of using videos to kind of get around that or some other stuff. But you want to just be wise. You're totally right. Because there's a lot involved in fitting. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Really, really great question, Golden. We appreciate you for asking. You got anything
else? And basically, make sure your craft
is
sufficient.
This is just like, do it right.
You bet.
You, Golden, but just like everybody in general.
Your craft has to be sufficient.
That's right.
Because when people are spending their money, they want a good product. They really do.
Yeah.
Because that's how the business grows, through word of mouth.
Yeah.
Not always who comes to you. Because people refer, and they refer, and they refer. So with that said, hone your craft real well.
And I'm not going to lie, I've been sewing for, I think, at least for professionally with clients for maybe 15 or so years. And when I first started, it had to be the most nerve-wracking thing to start because you are dealing with different body types and different types of garments. I don't know, Golden, if you're going to sell just one type, it might be super easy to do it. But like with mine, with fluctuating with formal wear, I mean, it went from very fitted to different. It just got a little nerve-wracking. But project by project, like Mr. Jim says, make sure that the craftsmanship is impeccable, and always create fail-safes. So let me interject this. I'm a muslin girl when it comes to sewing with clients. Even if I don't sew one for myself, I always create something so that my clients can kind of get a visual of what it looks like, and they can kind of get a sense of the fit, and I can make any adjustments to the final. So for me, it helps to serve as a barrier and kind of as a way of helping them see where things are going, and then helping us as a guardrail against any issues. So maybe that might be it. I've seen people send muslins in the mail. They're like, try this on. Let me see you by video.
Yeah, a lot of people do
try it on. This and that looks great. I'll send you the final. So there's a middle line way of doing it.
As you guys know, I had been asked through the years, what about my sewing? And one time I had several lines out through the years. And
these are lines of clothing, right?
This is a line of clothing that I did when I had a boutique.
Okay.
And I do everything one of a kind. And I found that the way I do my things, they're one of a kind. So it puts that whoever purchases my garment in a very special place because nobody else will have it. You know, when you buy something retail, if you don't make it yourself, they've made multiples of them. And women look at women. Okay, so I started a line of my classic look. It's called Classic Is Forever Classic. And you know, I've been posting and showing bits and pieces. A lot of people have been wanting to buy it, and I tell them, hold on, it's for the fall. See? And I finished a piece yesterday, and I want to show you guys what I do. You know, who maybe you hadn't looked online to see what I do, but this is my latest piece.
And if you missed it, please go sign up for his Instagram, because Mr. Jim is putting some fabulous stuff out. It looks really, really good. He made this for me. He just doesn't know it yet. No, I'm joking.
I sure did. But this is my last piece. And this is one of the other keys, because people say in how you match everything up. It should be.
It's pretty.
This
gorgeous
pattern is very busy. Very busy. So you have to match it up to where it looks what it is.
That is pretty amazing, especially with this. Is it? And it's floral. It's kind of neat. It has this whole, I like this motif.
Mm-hmm.
It's gorgeous, the colors and everything.
and that black background.
This fits you.
Does it fit me? I'm a little short waisted, narrow shoulder gal. If we're out of camera focus, we're sorry. We're standing. All right, and I'll bend down and see if it does. Now, I do have gorilla like arms, so they're super long. Ooh, that's fancy. Fancy jacket. Y'all see me? Have a look on me.
Mm-hmm.
It's all cute and black. Oh, nice. I love that black. Miss Jim, you're going to make me start sewing some jackets. It's nice. And then look at that. The wow factor, the pop of that lining color. Very nice. And it feels so good and substantial.
The reason why I want to show this is because I saw a post on Facebook and I tagged it because a lady did something out of upholstery and drapery factory.
Mm-hmm.
And people say, wow, I didn't know you could do that. And people say, yeah, I use it all the time. That's what I use.
Yeah,
this is upholstery fabric. Actually, this one is drapery fabric there. I use this a lot because you get a different look.
Yeah, it feels great.
You get a different look. It's not always heavy. You can get it in different weights and this, that, and the other.
It's actually really soft.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
very, very soft.
And you find, when you make things out of like this, you'll never find them in industry. Because
mm-hmm.
they're not going through these changes.
That's true.
See?
That's true.
So consider that, you sewers out there. Check out upholstery, drapery fabrics. And let me tell you a good place to find some very unique places. Go to a Goodwill or that type of place
mm-hmm.
because there's always somebody who donated a panel.
Oh, that's true, yeah. And yeah, that's a lot of fabric.
Or it's got a little stain somewhere, but that's a big piece of drapery fabric. You might buy it for $2 or $3.
Because you said you made this out of scraps, right?
Yeah, I made this out of nice. Leftovers.
Very nice.
Okay.
Very nice. Oh, and then just one thing. I'm going to do a shameless plug because I never usually do shameless plugs. Since we were kind of talking about having a sewing business and kind of getting everything straightened out with that, for those that don't know, I did do a course. Yes, I did it a while back ago. It's on how to do sewing consults successfully, and it's geared toward not just doing the consult. So the consult is where it starts with the client. If you have a sewing business, you have to have your processes and everything in order to ensure that, you know, everything goes well. It's not just about making the garment. It's also the business doing part.
Right.
So I created a really in-depth course. I think it's over like 3.5 hours, something like that. It deals with everything from all the proper paperwork to have, from creating a good business policy, the different personality types you may encounter, and how to interact with those. Because a lot of what we do dealing with the public is personality driven. So you have to know how to kind of like navigate that, how to conduct phone calls, answer questions, create disclaimers. Like, it's really in depth, and someone bought it recently and they like sang praises. So sometimes I don't promote enough, but if it's a resource that can help you guys, I want to put it out there. So I will include a link. Please check it out. It's only $29, but it will be well worth that.
Yeah.
It's weight and gold. So, and then come get Mr. Jim, when do these go live? When are you selling?
In fall.
Okay.
It'll be late September, early October.
And these are one of a kind, so keep an eye out.
And they will be signed.
Oh, are we doing like
I'm
the
signing
inside pop liners?
Each one. So if Picasso can do it, Gentleman Jim can.
It's a one of a kind.
It's a
it
one
is.
Of a kind.
So make sure you be on the lookout for that too. We'll
yeah.
be getting his website up. But
okay.
anyway, we love you guys.
See you guys later.
Take care. Bye. Yeah.
Gentleman Jim. Who is that coming?
Jim, here, let me.
It's the dressmaker. Who are you?
Just abruptly interrupting.
Working environment faces like this, you have to be really careful. Every time you handle the machine, threading it, whatever you're doing, you have to, health and safety reason, you have to switch your machine off. cotton, no fabric, no cotton on the floor because it's dangerous. You can step on it and slide and fall and hurt yourself. So therefore, that is really important. Needles, pins, nothing like that. You shouldn't throw them on the floor. Every tool you use, all the tools, it has to go back. Mustn't leave scissors, a snip, a screwdriver, anything laying around. Everything you use, everything for put back. That's the most important thing to work safely in this sort of environment. And some of the problems are, if there's cottons or fabric on the floor, you can step and slide and then you fell and you hurt yourself. And while you're threading the machine, if you don't switch the machine off, machine is quite fast. By accident, if you can press the pedal, and then you can, while your hand's under the machine, you can hurt your needle goes through your finger, and then you can hurt yourself. And then the same is the scissors. If you hold on scissors, it snip. You're walking around in the place, you can accidentally, you can injure someone. So therefore, that's sort of thing that we must avoid. So always you put the tools away, and when you walk around, make sure that you don't carry no scissors, nothing in your hand. So now I cut all my samples I'm going to make. Now I'm going to do 10 stitches using my foot as a guide, parallel to one another. I'm going to do 10 stitches. This is my 10 stitch. Now I'm going to do slow curve. I'm doing two straight lines. Two straight line. There's my two pieces of fabric. I'm going to put them together, make a seam. This is straight hem. Double needle seams I'm going to do. this is a strap, double needle, a strap. Maybe adjust into tension. You stitch it. And then it's because too loose, so therefore I'm tightening the tension. The first stitch before adjust the tension, second stitch after adjust the tension. That's the wrong stitch, that's the right stitch. Now we cut all shapes, so wave, circle, hard and straight. And then two pieces of fabric, putting it together and overlock it. Now we're doing demonstrating how to put them together, how to do the shapes and two pieces together. This is two pieces together. Wavy edges.